Thank you, Rabbi Jacobson. The first talk was brilliant, and I think most importantly, it was thought-provoking. I think you walk away with what to think about. I think it's really very valuable, very important, and we're very appreciative for that. For the second talk, didn't take much to choose the topic. I saw the topic. It was obvious that this was very important, a very important topic. Faith in times of crisis. So again, a warm welcome to Rabbi Jacobson.
I'm glad you're not bored yet of me, but I have to keep the entertainment going. Right, Rabbi? Okay. Faith in times of crisis. Okay. Where shall we begin? So as I mentioned in my previous talk briefly, I'll just elaborate. I got off the plane on Thursday morning. You know, these long flights. New York to LA is 6 hours. Then another hour layover. And 14 and a half hours to Sydney. I'm sure you've all made the trips, you know what I'm talking about. The good news about these type of trips is you just set your mind that it's like endless, so you have no expectations and you just surrender to the airspace and to the airplane food, if you know what I mean. I land in the morning, 6 a.m., Thursday morning, completely out of sorts because you don't know what time it is, what time zone you're in, you know, it's a different day, a different night. And we're driving back from the airport, and I think when I got to the hotel or beforehand, I hear this report, there's some breaking news in here in Sydney and Brisbane that they arrested someone. At the time told me 60 people, now I'm told it's 15. I can't even agree how many people were arrested. The bottom line is they're basically not really telling us all the facts, that's the point, which doesn't help the situations. How many people were arrested, does anyone know? What? One?
15.
It ends up being one?
15 and four have been charged. They only kept one.
Yeah, we can't even agree with the news. Okay, fine. It depends on which report you heard. Okay, the point is the point. Now, what's that? Did they ever announce what they were planning to do, these guys? Or?
Yes. Decapitate somebody. Yes. Grab a random person and decapitate them.
Really?
Random person.
Okay, that's why it's not good to open up questions to the audience because you don't get any clarity. Everybody's got a different report.
There was more than one group and there was more than one activity.
Now, the biggest question that we all have is why? What do they want? You know, that to me is like the because you can't even fight. You can't fight an enemy, you have no clue what they want, and they're like completely insidious. And so it reminded me immediately, in a sad way, of 13 years ago, September 11th in New York. It's exactly the same story. Not quite the same. There they did attack, tragically, and 2,500 people were dead as a result, which, as horrible tragedy it is, by the way, if you've ever been to New York, downtown Manhattan, on Tuesday morning, 50,000 could have easily gone. So that's like a miracle in that sense. Not a miracle for those that died, but I don't know if you've ever been downtown Manhattan, Tuesday morning, a weekday. It's impossible to fathom 2,000 people. I mean, so, but that's another story. But I remember vividly, I was walking to my office that morning. It was Tuesday morning, September 11th. You probably all remember where you were when you saw or heard about it. You was probably Wednesday already.
It was night. It was Monday night.
We saw it live.
We had morning here.
How's that?
It was Monday.
How'd they know that film?
Wednesday.
Oh, the second plane. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The first one we have.
It was Tuesday then. It was Tuesday morning.
For those of us who lived in South Africa at that time, it was at midday.
Okay. Not that it matters really in the scheme of in the scope of things. Who really cares, right? Anyway, I was walking to my office in New York, in Brooklyn. My office, I have an office above 770 Eastern Parkway, which some of you visited, you know, Crown Heights. And my office is upstairs. I was walking, it was 9 o'clock. It was ready after the both attacks, which were 8:41, I think, New York time. And there was, of course, the Pentagon, the third plane, and the fourth plane, which crashed somewhere in Pennsylvania. And a guy tells me, you know, go up to the roof, something's happening. Something happened. I go up to the roof of our building. So the World Trade Center is a pretty, you can see them anywhere from a building. And they were both smoking. You know, it was very surreal. Like these two big buildings smoking. You know, like, it's just smoke. And no clue what happened. So I called my father, get on the cell phone. It wasn't easy to get through to anyone because the cell phones were also all, they're all tied up because of, there must have been everybody calling everybody. And my father, I get on the phone, he didn't even hear about it. But my father always seemed to know about the news before it happened. He was a journalist. So he always knew things. You know that joke where the president of the United States says, how do the Jews know everything before it happens? So someone says they have a thing called a mikveh. You know, a mikveh is a ritual bath. And they go to the mikveh and that's where they share the news. So the president says, you know what? The best source of information. He dresses up as a Hasidic Jew. He comes to Brooklyn. He goes into the mikveh and he meets another Jew. And someone told him to say the words, Vos Herzach. You know, what's going on? So he says to another Jew, what's Herzach? He says, we've got to get out of here. The president's coming. So, anyway, my father seemed to know the news always beforehand. And I finally get through to him. And he didn't know about it. He didn't hear anything yet. He said to me, Muslim terrorists, without missing a beat. Immediately knew. I never asked him how he knew. He just knew. He had his pulse on, hands on the pulse. He knew what was going on. Anyway, they chased us off the roof, the police, because remember that morning there was such panic and havoc. No one had idea what's coming. It could have been, who knows, God forbid, I don't even want to say it. They could have bombed every tunnel and every bridge. I mean, the United States, the bridge, they're all open. Suicide bomber just goes into the Holland Tunnel and then just blows himself up, and that's that. So thank God they didn't have that much brains. Whatever, I don't know if that's brains or that much anger. But I remember, the World Trade Center, and the thing that shocked me, besides, of course, that's completely out of, like, what do they want? The first time I believe in history that there's a war being fought where we have no clue what the enemy wants. Or most people have no clue. Even Hitler, in his obscene and brutal objectives, we knew exactly what he wanted. The Aryan race was the pure race. Everyone else should be enslaved. He wants Lebensraum he wants the whole earth. And Jews and other undesirables, annihilated. So as obscene, as horrible as it is, it was clear. We also knew the boundary. He was in Germany. Here's where the enemy is, identifiable. Now there's a war. Who's going to win? But here in this situation, number one, we don't know who they are. Where are they? How many? We have no idea what they want. You can't even surrender if you want to. Not that anyone's thinking of doing that. Which is like, you know, very unprecedented. And I want to address it because I think, you know, defanging the enemy, or put it this way, clarity is half the way to diffuse fear. The worst type of fear is the unknown, when you're uncertain. And as Jews, I think we have not only an obligation to achieve our own clarity, I think we could help the world really understand what's going on. And when you understand the enemy, you're always in the driver's seat. In this situation right now, they can be just a few. And we can have the greatest armies, but if they have the element of surprise, meaning that we have no idea where they're coming from, when they want, and so on, suddenly middle Australia, what happened? Nothing happened. It's one thing you could say if Sydney or Australia suddenly deported all the Muslims, which some consider would be a good idea. Is this being recorded?
No.
Yes, it is. It's not being broadcast, but it's being recorded. It's fine, I don't mind. But so, you could say, so even that would not be justifiable to have terrorism, but at least there's some semblance of a rational reason. And this is, we must address this issue, in my opinion, because it's the root. You could talk about symptoms all day. Look what just happened. I was in Israel during the 9 days during the war in Gaza. So I was very happy to be there. Not happy there's a war, but happy to be there because there was a certain unity, and I feel that Every Jew is targeted. So this, why should the Jews be there? I mean, you think we're not... If you'd be in Israel, you'd be just as targeted. So I feel that we owe each other a solidarity, especially after the Holocaust, which unfortunately some Jews felt it's not our problem, it's their problem. We can't have that attitude anymore. But it's strange that the Muslim world is actually bringing it to our doorstep, whether you like it or not. So though I don't like to call it a blessing in disguise, definitely not a positive thing, September 11th, in many ways, has a positive element. I'll tell you what it is. Only one thing. Not the deaths, obviously. They're tragic. As a matter of fact, I know some of the people that were killed. There's actually one that comes to mind. Remember, September 11th that year, 13 years ago, was a Tuesday before Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah was Shabbos that year. And there was a Cantor Fitzgerald, there was a firm where many Jews, almost everyone in that firm was killed. One of them was a young man who worked there, and his wife, Delphine, was pregnant in her ninth month. She gave birth on Yom Kippur, 10 days at Yom Kippur, 2 weeks after the attack, and the son she gave birth to, his bar mitzvah this year, is named after the father that was killed, because that baby never saw his father. So I'm quite aware, personally, of the tragedy, and we can't minimize it, but the only positive element is what's called clarity. You know, an enemy, you don't know where they are, is far worse than when you know where they are, and you know that they're there. In the book of Daniel, there's a verse that says that at the end of times, when Mashiach comes, there'll be Yizbaru v'Yislabnu Hadvar. It means there'll be clarity. So it's far better to know and see there's an enemy than not even know, is this person your enemy or your foe? Foe or friend? But the fact that they brought it to the United States, not, and didn't only remain some type of abstract thing happening. Excuse me. Thank you. And an abstract thing happening in the Middle East, the mere fact that creates clarity, because now we see what they want. And again, I'm not suggesting any blessing. The fact that now in Australia, Sydney, there's this threat, and thank God it was preempted. But now we know it's a serious thing, and we know that they're a real enemy. And it makes no difference if there are 5 or 10 of them. Frankly, it's not 5 or 10. And that, so that clarity is already a blessing. Because it's far worse. Look what Israel, we know today that the tunnels that were discovered due to those attacks, what were they going to do? Rosh Hashanah. In a few days, they were going to be coming out from tunnels all over, dressed as Israeli soldiers. They had the uniforms, and they were going to attack. Imagine in the middle of Rosh Hashanah, they're attacking. You don't know who's Israeli soldier, who's... Just the chaos and the confusion, it could have been... I don't even want to say the numbers. And by the time Israel would realize, because they were not prepared for such an attack. You know, your terrorist attack, 1, 2. But this would have been a nightmare. The worst type. So, no one's suggesting a blessing here, but the mere fact that we see clear, and Hamas and its stupidity, had they really done it right, they should have kept it completely secret. They should never attack beforehand. Allowed us to expose the tunnels, allowed us to expose these conspiracies. However, this is a half of a consolation. So now we have clarity, at least, that there's an enemy. We know that they're ready to do anything. The problem is we still have no solution. Because everything that has happened the last, let's say, month in Israel, at best, even the most optimistic people will say, at best, it's putting out a fire. You put out a fire. But you didn't eliminate the combustion chamber of many more fires. Who questions, who's even has a doubt? As soon as they rearm with more rockets, they're not ready for the next attack. And the same thing in the southern Lebanon, the same thing in any other country. So we're dealing with a situation that is like almost, like we have to just wake up every morning with a hope that everything is just all right today. And we have no plan or strategy. How do you attack the root of the issue? Because most people have no clue what the root of the issue is. And I say, even the great, mighty United States, with its president, maybe worse than all, has no clue. They're clueless, or they want to be clueless, because they're not interested in dealing with the root of the issues. Maybe it's too complicated. There's too much oil that we're addicted to in Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries and so on. So I want to address the root of the issue as bluntly as I can. I don't think we should mince any words. You have to know what it is. My friends, it comes down to one thing. It's a religious war. It's an ideological war. It's not a military war in the sense where Hitler was not a religious war. He wanted land. He wanted the resources. He wanted the control. This is a religious war. The people who are perpetrating, what they're perpetrating, believe that this is God's will. And that's why for them, repulsive things and gruesome beheadings don't bother them. So the first thing I went to look at, and I'll give you some of the results of my research when I back to September 11th, and frankly, everything relevant then is relevant today. Nothing changed. Only 13 years have passed, and thank God there hasn't been much worse than what we've seen. But nothing has changed, because what happened after September 11th that should have changed anything? Nothing changed in the Muslim world. If anything, you have more militants today than then. Nobody was destroyed. You killed a few people. Bin Laden was killed. So what? It wasn't like the head of the serpent. Once you kill bin Laden, there are no more Muslim militants. It's not true at all. There's far more today than there were then. So that tells you we're dealing at best with some symptoms. So the issue is, what is the root? And I speak now as a Jew. When I went to do research, the first thing I wanted to see, because what's your first reaction when you hear someone hijacking a plane and flying it into a building? You think they're either mentally disturbed. You know, that would be the reaction. Because you're going to your absolute certain death in a completely crazy way and just randomly just going into a building and kill anyone that comes my way. You don't see this every day. Usually it's a madman. For example, in the United States, you have from time to time these guys that go on a shooting spree on a campus, at a military complex, and so on. You know, I don't know if anything's ever happened like that here. Hope not. Okay, usually it's a mentally disturbed person or someone that has a deep grievance. He lost a job, he's angry at everybody, he's angry at society, some malcontent, etc. But and here you look at none of them are that way. None of them are criminals. It's not like they took convicts out of prison and gave them machine guns and airplanes and go kill everyone, you know, which is usually the case in films and in novels and so on. Number two, they're educated people. They're not particularly suffering from poverty or like feel a grievance against society. So what would make someone do that? Normal people usually don't take their lives. What would inspire someone?
You know, that's,
but we have to go further than that. So I went even further. I started researching. And also bin Laden himself. What kind of guy was he? Now, you study his life. He was an aristocrat. He came from an aristocratic, privileged family in Saudi Arabia. Wealth, education, a Western education, spoke English, you know, and a younger man didn't have any of these. No one saw in him some type of like violent trend. He was seen as a gentle person, actually, as strange as it may sound. And then something changed. What? No, obviously, but what was that ideology? I want to address that. What is that ideology? And I want to begin by saying I think the biggest problem, which is maybe the most frightening thing of all, is not even the Muslim world. It's our world, the Western world. The Western world refuses by all means to acknowledge that this has anything to do with religion. And I spoke about this last night at North Shore, and someone who works in the government tells me, everybody, whether it's Australian leaders or American leaders or European leaders, they all want to say it's nothing to do with Islam. Complete insanity.
But that's politics. That's their politics.
Huh? That's it. Now, okay, so like they say, not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims. And they all are advocating and quoting Islam theology. I must admit this, even though this is, I hope you don't look at me in different eyes, I forced myself to watch a beheading. If you want to leave now, fine. Not because I actually enjoyed it, trust me, I almost threw up. But I wanted my blood to boil, to be very honest. I wanted to see the enemy right in the eyes and see what they do. And was the most chilling thing for me was, I won't go into any gruesome details, was when they yell out at the end, Allah Akbar, that God is the greatest. You know, it's bad enough what they're doing, but then God is all, like, this is like an offering to God. Like, unbelievably, you know. So I began reading more and more, trying to understand what were the influences that shaped bin Laden, shaped those other people. What is so seductive that's getting people to sign up to ISIS as we speak? They're Australian citizens joining them. Yeah. Why?
And
Indonesia, by the way, is the largest Muslim country. As you know, Muslim and Arab, I should say, is not synonymous. There are Arab countries that are not Muslim, not Arab. For example, Turkey is an Arab country, not necessarily Muslim, and Iran is a Muslim country, but not Arab. Right. Indonesia is the largest population. Now, so you may know, I don't know if you've ever read about it, but the people who, the group of people who hijacked those planes in Boston, that took off in Boston and then ended up in New York and Washington and so on, they discovered all the documents that they had with them before they went out on that infamous day. And besides some other things that they did that night before, which I don't think is appropriate to mention in shul, which is also an interesting paradox, that they have no problem with waiting for virgins in paradise while they're doing all this in the name of God. That's just yet another interesting footnote. I guess they have issues with their sexuality, but they had documents that were found that were all religious documents. And I read them. They're in Arabic, but I read translations. And it was, to me, extremely, even more disturbing than the actual text, because these documents they were reading, what if you didn't know better, and I'll say, l'havdil, elef havdolos, God forbid, they sound like Yom Kippur prayers. They do. They're talking about God being the greatest. There's no mention of murder. There's no mention of infidels. There's no mention of killing. There's all mention of being God, of being serving God in this world, that you have to do whatever it takes to serve God. And sometimes that includes challenging activities and so on. No reference. Purely like religious texts. And very calming texts. They like they calm you. They say that everything in this world is superficial and the material world is temporary. The only thing that lasts is God and God's purpose. And they don't even call for suicide. It's not about death. It's all about connecting to God. This is what they're reading. Okay, so you know, detective work, start retracing the steps, where are we going to? So then I finally discovered that Bin Laden was a student who considered himself a student. His mentor was a man called Said Qutb. Q-U-T-B is his name. Now, you can look it up, you'll find whatever I found, but I didn't find anything secret. I just searched, I went all the way. I didn't want to stop just with the symptoms. And this guy Qutb was, just for the record, he was executed by Nasser, President Gamal Abdul Nasser of Egypt, in 1968, though he was Arab, Nasser was. Nasser was basically the leader of the Arab world at the time, Six-Day War. He was the big inciter. He was the one that, you know, you have pictures of him inciting. And he essentially led the war against Israel, which of course they were all completely destroyed, the Egyptian army and the air force, etc. Now, he executed him because he was like the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a threat to the more secular, more secularized Muslim and Arab world. But this Qutb is a scholar. He wrote an 80-volume commentary on the Quran. Okay, clearly a scholar and pretty smart guy when you read his documentation. You see, obviously, like all of them, terrible, horrible, rabid anti-Semitism. But beyond that, his ideas are very seductive. Trust me, they didn't seduce me because our ideas come before his ideas. But his ideas, you could see right away how it would capture impressionable young minds. So let me just give you the gist of it. And I, obviously, Rabbi, I'm sure you know that I'm not here to give a Muslim primer, and just in case you want. But there's an expression, me'oivai techakmeni. From our enemies we become wise. My enemies make me wise. So sometimes it's important to know the enemies. You may know it in a more popular version from the Book of Psalms when Al Pacino in The Godfather says that you keep your friends close and you keep your enemies closer. Okay, that's a direct plagiarism from King David's Book of Psalms. But what's new? They all plagiarize us all the time. You know. So what do we learn from the enemy? So Qutb. Here's, I'll just give you the gist of his philosophy. He begins by saying, this is the God created the universe in order to for us to transform the world and turn it into a divine place. Pretty good? So far, so good. Okay? And but it's a challenge, because the material world is very selfish and very greedy and very very narcissistic. So it's a challenge. So God chose a nation to help lead the world in that direction. You know who that was? The Jews. He accepts the Bible. The Jewish people were chosen. They were chosen to be the guiding light to the entire nation world, the pagan world, to accept a God, and to, instead of focusing on self-interest, to focus on bringing virtue and kindness to the world. Okay, no one disagrees so far. Then he goes on and says, however, the Jews failed. Instead of embracing God and so on, they built a golden calf. They started sinning and transgressing, until the point that they just simply failed at the mission. So God then chose another group called the Christians. He took a Jew and sent them to the Christian world, to the pagan world, and hopefully the Christians would do the job. And they failed even more miserably and became more corrupt and power and so on. So then God finally chose his final prophet, Muhammad, and the religion of Islam was born. The final chosen people are the Muslims, that they will do the job that the Jews and the Christians could not accomplish. Now, step aside a moment as being a Jew, or a Christian for that matter. Up till here, you could say we fundamentally disagree. Who are you to say who God chose? But, so listen, he's entitled to a theory, that's his theory. But then he goes on to say, and how do we accomplish this mission? All means are at our disposal. You can't do it peacefully, you do it violently. And he calls for military jihad. But remember, you're not fighting, it's not a political war, you're not fighting for treasures, you're not fighting for money or power, you're fighting to transform a decadent world into a godly world. But what happened? The Ottoman Empire rose, and God's mission was being fulfilled. It was great. The Arab Muslim kingdom, the Muslim caliphate, began to spread all over, first from the peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula, to the west, Israel, North Africa, even to Spain. That's the extent it reached. But then began the battles of what you'll hear language today like this, the Crusader and Zionist plot. You hear this all the time. You know, Crusaders weren't around for 600 years. Why are people referring to them? Because this is the foundation, the fundamental principle of the theology. It's a war against God, which is the Western Roman Christian world and the Jewish world are fighting what God wants, which is the Muslim conquest of the universe in a spiritual way. Why do you think you find mosques built in all the Jewish and Christian holy sites? Why the two mosques on the Temple Mount? Why there? Because this is a sign of God's will in their mind that every religious site is not going to be Jewish, not Christian, is going to be Muslim. Every Muslim leader knew, and every Ottoman leader knew that you build a mosque in those places, that's a sign that that's what God wants. It's not just that, oh, it's a nice place, a nice piece of real estate. They choose the holiest sites. And it's a symbol. That's why Israel is unacceptable to a Muslim. Now, I will say clearly, I know Muslims, I don't believe all Muslims are murderers or want to be murderers, but they're all sympathetic to the theology. And that's why it's a breeding ground. What's the theology? That Israel, even though it's one sliver of land, what is it compared to all the land that they have? It still disturbs them, because it's a sign of a desecration of God's will. Simple as that. Nobody, you never hear this. You're not going to hear a headline about this, an essay, an article, because the Western world is horrified to think like this. Because who wants to hear about religious wars? I'll soon discuss that, more of that. But let's go back to Kitab. And then he continues on. Then he goes off in his theories about Jews, which is, you could see he never met any Jews. So you could see he's just an anti-Semite, period. And I should say it, because for all the so-called eloquence of his ideas, but when it comes to Jews, you see the guy completely loses it. Like Hitler. You know, they start talking things that are completely, like for example, he says that all Jews have a slave mentality. Because we're still, when we came out of Egypt, we're still slaves. Anyone that knows, a Jew knows no Jew has slave mentality. Maybe husbands and wives argue who's the master of the house, but that's about it. And even that, we know who's won that battle. But, you know, they say the man wears the pants in the house and the woman tells him what pants to wear. But that's the extent of the slavery goes. So to say Jews are slaves, you know that they thought that, I mentioned. Anyway, I'm just throwing in a little humor to lighten the... Yeah, somewhat. Now, but going back to the theme, bottom line is then he calls for to do whatever it takes, militant, violent, and so on. And then quoting the Quran, you have all the expressions about beheadings and killings and all that, but they don't see it as murder. It's not like they're insensitive to death. If you think about it, it's like what the Germans did. How did they get the German people to so easily turn on Jews? They spent years with a propaganda machine to dehumanize human beings. Once you think of Jews, God forbid, as insects, so what's the big thing? You spray a mosquito spray, so you kill a Jew with gas. Once you dehumanize someone, it becomes far easier to kill them. So once you think that this is God's will, so why should your repulsion to beheading or blood be in the way. It's your own problem. I know this sounds ridiculous to us, but think about it for a moment. So it was extremely seductive and extremely attractive to minds like bin Laden, who probably did not have a vision and a clarity. They may have had wealth and education, but this was a vision. This made sense to them. And they probably didn't begin by saying, let's kill everybody. They began by saying, let's bring God everywhere. And then you do whatever it takes. And this is the reason. Why? What did they want when they attacked in New York and Washington and the United States? They weren't interested. It's not like usually before an invasion, the enemy attacks you, you know, surprises you, and then suddenly there's a whole invasion. It didn't follow by an invasion. They wanted to do exactly that, to show us that the great Satan is what the United States is called by them. It's commonly called great Satan, which means anti-God. And they wanted to show that in your middle of your world financial center, in the middle of your decadence, your money, your power, which is so godless, we will strike you and we're not afraid of you. That is exactly what they want. And exactly what they want in Australia too. They see the Western world, and the Western world for them means everything. Europe, the United States, Australia, Canada, all the countries that fit into that category is essentially decadent. Now, Kitab actually visited America, United States. And of course, he went to Hollywood and Broadway. So it only confirmed all his fears. And he went back and said, yes, absolutely, decadent. Now, I'm not even ready to argue and say that the Western world doesn't have plenty of decadence. We've got plenty of decadence. But you know something? So does the Muslim world. Let's not kid ourselves. So it's ridiculous to just accuse the Western world. But yes, there is decadence. It's true, there are places that are godless. We're not denying that. The question is, how do you deal with it? And that's what I'm going to get to in a few minutes. So this type of mind, like Kitab, and I think there's another one, I forgot his name, there's another type of father of Muslim fundamentalism, this is what shapes these minds. And when you read it, it becomes so natural to understand where they're coming from. Not sympathetic, don't get me wrong, but you understand at least. People indoctrinated with a belief. And remember, the Muslim world is far more religious. Even secular Muslims pray 5 times a day. I'm not talking about, there are exceptions. Well, you remember the Arab Spring, which is funny actually to call it that today. It's more like an Arab winter. But an Arab Spring in Egypt, they would all stop demonstrations when it came to the 5 times a day prayer. Because Muslims still, you know, even though not everyone follows Sharia, which is their Muslim law, but everyone respects it. And Muslim theology dominates those countries. That's who rules the countries, from Saudi Arabia through Qatar, through Kuwait, the whole region. So it's also something we don't really relate to. Because by us, in our world, there are people who go to synagogue, people who don't. There are people who go to church, people who don't. In the Muslim world, you may not go to mosques, but the 5 times a prayer, if there's a call to prayer, everybody stops. There's a respect for it. Whether it's a healthy respect or not is irrelevant. The point is, it's a different culture and climate that most of us don't really relate to. And as such, because they don't have a secularism that has entered. I think, and I'm ready to say this very clear, I think that Islam is today where Christianity was in the 16th century, 17th century maybe. I know that sounds like bad news because it means another 3 centuries to tolerate this. We won't be around. But I think it can happen quicker, and that's the point of what I want to get to. But I think that's where they are. If you look at the world, the Western world in the 16th, 17th century, who controlled the countries? The monarch and the church. That was it. No one else. There was no second party. There was no democracy. No one asked anybody. There was no respect for individual rights. The only ones that held on to the concept of individual rights quietly throughout history is, yes, yours truly, the Jewish people. But we didn't have control over empires. We were the biggest victims of everybody, both the Christians and the Muslims. And if you look at what the Christians did in the Middle Ages, it's probably far worse than what we see today. Today, it's shocking because we have democracies, we have freedoms. Then, it was the Crusades, they marched through Europe killing indiscriminately Jerusalem. I mean, it was the Wild West in that sense. And religion dominated. You couldn't do nothing about it. There was no recourse. You know, today you can arrest somebody. You can defend yourself. We have armies. There, the church was the problem. They were the army. They were the government. So imagine, God forbid, ISIS suddenly controls the world. That's it. That's what the world was like then. Now, I'm not going to suggest that every century, every leader was a terrorist then, a Christian terrorist, but what was the Spanish Inquisition if not threatening people? Either you convert or you're dead. That's why Jews went undercover, the Maranos. As a matter of fact, Islam was far more benevolent. Even the more aggressive ones demanded that publicly you behave like a Muslim, but privately you can make a Seder in your house. They had no problem with it. Maimonides actually has a whole series of correspondence saying that in such conditions you're allowed to go into a mosque, because a mosque was not considered idolatry. So the Muslims were actually far more moderate than the Christians were in those days. So if you want to put things into context. But the good news is the Christians ultimately did get tamed. You know, we would not have a country like Australia, I'm talking about as a Western country, or the United States, that became a haven for people of all walks of life. The concepts of freedom of religion, all the Bill of Rights, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, is relatively new. It's only 250 years old, 300 years old. You know, Chou Enlai, the Prime Minister of China, was the Prime Minister when President Nixon went to visit there, 1971. It was after China, after Mao Zedong died, and China opened up somewhat to the West. So Western journalists asked him, the Prime Minister of Chou Enlai, what does he think, what's his opinion about the French and American revolutions? So his classic answer was, it's too early to tell, you know? Because remember, it's only 250 years old. Chinese culture is over 1,000 years. And as a matter of fact, I hear from people who do business in China that Chinese don't respect anyone except Jews. Not because of religious reasons, because of longevity. Because it's only because they respect something that's been around so long. You know, I don't know the extent of that respect, and I don't know how much we can test it, you know, but that's what people tell me. Anyway, the point being is that that ultimately Christianity got tamed. If you want to read an interesting book, read the book, it's called On Two Wings, by a scholar called Michael Novak. Not a Jewish scholar. He writes, and it's not a theoretical book, he documents it, it's an academic book, he documents it in the language of the founding fathers of the United States. Basically that the freedoms that we cherish so much in the Western world are built completely, what he calls Jewish metaphysics, not Christian thought, completely Jewish metaphysics. And you see it in the language of these great minds, which is fascinating. They weren't exposed to too many Jews. Who do they know? John Adams, Jefferson, Monroe, and Paine, and some others. Maybe that's why they got it, because they didn't meet any Jews. Maybe that was it. They just read the Bible untainted, you know. But they took the principles from Torah. Because Abraham was the first one that advocated. What did he stand for? He stood up against a pagan, selfish world that was worshiping themselves and the idols that they created, and said, no, we were created in the divine image, not God is created in our image. That changed all of history. That one statement. That not you may create a God in your image, which means you run the show. God created us in his image, and he's the one that runs the show. I know he, I'm saying he. It, she, whatever term you want to use. Again, there's the female part of the God tells the male part of the God which pants to wear. Maybe that's how we should put it. So Abraham taught these principles, and he sacrificed his life for it, together with his wife Sarah, and the world changed. But at the time, the only ones that really embraced it were the children of Abraham. Now, who are the children of Abraham? This really gets intriguing. Number one was Isaac, so he's the ancestor of the Jewish people. But there was Yishmael, the ancestor of who? The Muslim Arab world. The next generation, Jacob and Esau are the children of Isaac. Jacob, again, is the ancestor of the Jews. And Esau, grandson named Rome. His grandson was named Rome. Rome is the name of a grandchild of Esau. So the Western Christian world that would later become the Christian Western Roman world comes from the children of Esau. What would later become the Arab Muslim world comes from the children of Yishmael, all children of Abraham. And they are all charged, but Abraham taught them all the path of God. However, the reason that the conflicts took place in the times of Abraham and they take place today is because when you're dealing with God, it's like playing with fire. Holy wars are very powerful because it's in the name of God. And if it's not harnessed properly, religion can destroy. That's a fact. And Abraham's great challenge in his own home was, how do you teach your children to be very devout but not be judgmental? To be very spiritual and not be condescending? That was his challenge. I'll just share a story from the Talmud which captures it in subtle form. was a man, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. His name was Rashbi. You may have heard of him. His yahrzeit is on Lag BaOmer. There's a big pilgrimage in Israel every year to his gravesite up in northern Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people go there. I don't know if you've ever been. Okay. So Rashbi had to hide 12 years from the Romans because they decreed, they prohibited the study of Torah. So he was a great teacher. They were looking for him. And he had to hide for 12 years. He hid in a cave. Whole story, how he was fed, etc. After 12 years, you can imagine being secluded and separate from all of civilization. He came out very refined. The decree was over. He came back to civilization. And the Talmud says, interesting story, that whatever he looked at, because he was so refined, began to burn. Because when he saw the pettiness and the superficiality and the mundane, crass life of common folk, it was so disturbing to him that everything began to burn. Well, physically, metaphorically, however you interpret it. So God says to him an interesting thing. He says, you're not mature enough. You're not ready. Go back for a 13th year, bar mitzvah. And one more year of maturity, and then you'll come back. And now when he came back, whatever he looked at didn't burn. He found ways to repair it. He met people who were petty. He taught them to be a little more soulful. He met people who were superficial, taught them to be a little more introspective. Any situation he saw, he repaired. So you would think, one second, is that like a downgrade or upgrade? Before, everything burned. He was so spiritual. But in Judaism, we're not here to destroy the world. If you're going to consume the world with religious passion, everyone will be dead. Because all of us have flaws, and we all have evil inclinations. We've all made our mistakes. So Abraham's real challenge was not just to teach the path of God and justice, but what do you do when you meet injustice? So you have a story with Abraham that, like, to me, answers all the questions, which I completely befuddles us, why the Muslims don't understand this. The Bible tells a story of Abraham confronting infidels. There was a city called Sodom and Gomorrah, the two wicked cities. God tells Abraham, reluctantly, that he wants to destroy these cities. What does Abraham do? You'd think Abraham, the passionate religious person, should begin to celebrate. Finally, you know, we always ask the question, the wicked are prospering and the good are suffering. Finally, the wicked are going to suffer. Abraham should have been applauding. Instead, he challenges God, no, maybe there are 50 righteous people there. And he starts arguing with God, how can you do such a thing to a country, to a nation? How could the just judge of the entire universe will be called as someone who's not doing justice? So what do you do with infidels? And Abraham, the man of God, because he realized the path of God is the path of compassion. And whatever you can do to help heal someone, that's what you have to do. You don't celebrate their death. And even if, God forbid, at the end of the day, God overruled him and said, no, they're too cruel, and I have to kill them, Abraham cries that day. He doesn't laugh. We cry when wicked people die, because that human beings fell to such a point where they could not be redeemed. That should kill. That should hurt us. So I don't understand how any Muslim can even think of hurting someone else. If they really believe in God, you believe that God created everyone in the divine image. The fact that they may have sinned, so first of all, who says that you were given the right to judge someone else? Even if so, you should be looking for compassionate ways to inspire them. So to me, that's why I'm convinced that the Muslim world is where the Christians were 16th century. They just are immature. It's like telling someone, here's what God wants, and you don't have the maturity to know how to handle it. Now, I know this sounds philosophical, and I don't want to forget that they're actually killing people and there's danger involved. So I'm not trying to get naive and start turning this into only idealism. But the root of it is idealism, for sure. The problem is when it gets down to on the ground level, it's actually life and death. So no question, short term, kill them all, frankly, from my point of view. Nuke them all, what do you say, you know? Obviously, it has to be done with discretion and so on. But, you know, someone's coming to kill you, you do whatever it takes. It's complete defense. It's not even a question. I mean, in that sense, it's insanity how Israel is being attacked by anti-Semites. It's complete insanity. If someone came to you, I always tell people, let's take this out of the global platform. So you have a home, and your neighbor hates you and says to you, listen to me. Either you move out of your home or you give me your living room or else I'm going to kill you. Okay? And they swear, they say, we want your annihilation. The charter of Hamas says the extinction of every Jew and extinction of Israel. All. Not just Jerusalem, but also Tel Aviv. And then they suddenly send a rocket into your living room, God forbid. What are you going to do? You're going to say, oh, you know what, do me a favor, don't send any more rockets. You know, please, my children have to sleep. You'll do is you'll demolish them before they do anything to you. It's ridiculous. It's not even a question. Forget about it. You have grievances? Fine, we'll sit down, we'll talk about grievances. What did the Jews do after World War II? 6 million, a third of our people were decimated. Why didn't we go and bomb German cafes? Then when Israel became a state, why didn't we take the Air Force and just bomb the whole damn Germany? Every country did that in vengeance throughout history. You look throughout history, what did countries do when they were attacked? As soon as they came into power, vengeance was number one. Because it's not in our blood, that's not how we think. Our vengeance is building our families and homes, like every Holocaust survivor will tell you. You want my vengeance? They open up a photo album, and they show you their children and grandchildren. That's our vengeance. I was in Berlin a number of years ago on Hanukkah. So I went to the Brandenburg Gate, there where Hitler stood. You have these images, you know, with hundreds of thousands of his troops, of the Jugendrat, like those unbelievable images. I mean, horrible images. And that's where he stood. So I'm looking, what's their Hanukkah now, where he stood? A Hanukkah menorah. Yeah. And to the left is a Christmas tree. So I asked the Rabbi Techtel, I said, how'd you pull that off? You got the Hanukkah menorah right in the middle. He says, I convinced one of the guys that...